Hi, hello, and welcome back to another episode of the Ideas Podcast. Thank you for returning. With me today is Linnea, and we're going to be chatting about lots and lots of stuff. First things first, this is not, as you know, really an L&D podcast. That's the cover story. The reason you're here is to find out what we're drinking. So, Linnea, what are you drinking today?
I am drinking an original Coca-Cola.
Oh,
that is my go-to beverage.
There we go. I struggle with Coca-Cola. I really like the taste. I do not like the feeling it leaves on my teeth. It's just one of those kind of, oh, I can't. Yeah. Hmm. But Coke Zero doesn't have the feeling afterwards for me, but the flavour is not great, shall we say.
I would say any light product, that is, or any fake sugar product, to me, yeah. I'm like, I'd rather just skip it. Like, can I have the sugar version or just not? Like, I'd rather have tap water than Coke Zero.
Fair enough. There we go. Yeah. And I am having coffee today in my rather fetching pink water mug. Games Workshop sent me, which was very nice. I've been drinking coffee from the Many Worlds Taverns company. Mm-hmm. They're like a D&D themed coffee company.
Oh,
it's
wow.
Fantastic. So what have we? We've just finished a bag of Homely House, very Lord of the Rings oriented. Mm-hmm. This is every month they do like a special one off coffee as well, where they also send you like items to use in your games of D&D and a pack of dice. Which is very cool, because I needed more dice in my life. You know,
everyone does.
They have a YouTube channel, and we recently discussed on there the fact that there are two things you can't have enough of, coffee and dice. Excellent. Anyway, I feel like we've done that portion now, so let's dive in. I said at the start we'd do introductions, so Linnea, introduce yourself. Tell us a bit about you.
Oh, yeah. So the big identity question. No, but let's just do it simple. My name's Linnea Sjögren. I live in Stockholm, Sweden, where I have my own L&D shop, I guess you could say. Mostly just me and a few sub-consultants when needed. I do basically anything, everything learning. I say I have a Swiss Army knife approach. So I am not an expert in one thing, but I can do most things. And my kind of motto in life is, how hard can it be? So usually I love trying new things, new tools, new software, new anything. Just seeing what you can do with it and what I can do that I couldn't do before.
Brilliant. Yeah, it's interesting that comes across in what you kind of share, in the variety of what you share. And you know what? We did the initial bit, but I say this isn't a planned podcast, but I always kind of do, what should we ask as the first question chat before we start? I'm going to change that. That's going out the window. Because I think this is a really interesting topic about generalism versus niching into one area of expertise. Mm. It's getting increasingly hard, I think, in my experience anyway, to find generalists.
Yes, I agree.
Because I've worked very hard to stay there, because I hate the idea of not doing a bit of everything. I can't like, there's stuff I'm really interested in and stuff I'm good at, but I kind of don't want to give up for the other stuff as well. What is it that kind of keeps you focusing on that generalism rather than going, that's the thing I'm going to do?
I think, well, one of the things is just the curiosity, right? Like, I need to know what's going on in the world and what's happening and what tools are coming out and what you can do with them. And I'm never completely happy with anything that I do or any tool that I have, right? There's always room for improvement. And so I'm always looking for, you know, what else, what more. The other thing is I would be bored beyond belief if I had to do the same thing for a longer period of time. I mean, just for me, like, even if I do like a lot of animated video, just being able to switch animation tool, like, will help me enjoy my work more.
Yeah, no, I think that it's kind of similar. I feel like there would be a little bit less joy in running my company if I just did one thing all the time. I was chatting to someone not long ago and they were saying that, I just deal with healthcare. Just healthcare, just in America, that's all I create content for. And hey, you know, they love their job and I guess maybe it's just a fundamental difference in where and how you find joy in what you do, maybe, I don't know.
Yeah, and I think it's an approach thing as well. I had a discussion with, so I'm a mentor for the GLDC, so I have a few mentees, and one of them, we had a conversation about the sort of generalist specialist thing and where they should sort of go with their career and what they should be thinking about, and they said like, I'm having trouble with my subject matter experts, so I'm wondering if I should just, you know, learn an area, say healthcare or whatever, and create learning inside of that, so I'm not as dependent on having good SMEs, right? Which I thought was really interesting, and I can absolutely see the appeal of that. But once again, I would be bored out of my mind if I had to make only healthcare content. And it's one of the things I love. It's like the variety of content I get to create, and because I get to learn new things as well, and I get to peek into worlds that I would never have. Because I make a lot of content for a cleaning company here in Sweden, and oh my gosh, the specifics, you never knew you needed so much knowledge to clean something. But once you do, you're like, yeah, this is serious stuff. Like this, the last course I made for them was about hospital cleaning, which is super relevant, right? Because how you clean a hospital will basically determine how well disease will spread, etc. So that's no joke. And just realizing like all the things you do and why you do them in a certain order and why the material matters. It's fascinating. But I would never stumble upon that any other way. Right. And then before that, I had a customer, a client who wanted a course on domestic violence. So it's just the variety. And I kind of try to screen my clients to make sure that they have a fairly good subject matter expert.
Yeah.
But I mean, the struggle is real. Like, we all know that.
Absolutely.
I wouldn't be able to do it.
No, it's interesting to touch on kind of SMEs there, because I think increasingly there's become an awareness of how important this relationship is and the ability to build these relationships. And certainly I know when I started, and I got into LD by doing loads of formal courses and stuff like that, because I kind of figured that was the direction I wanted to, there was very little in any of that about working with SMEs. There was far more time spent talking about learning styles, which proved to be maybe less useful than they might have imagined at the time. Who knew? Then you kind of you hit the job and you kind of went, oh, these SME people, they're a pain in the ass, basically. And only later, I think, did you kind of realize, oh, no, hang on, they're not. Maybe it's a bit more I'm being quite difficult to work with. Or, you know, yes, could we've branded be, yeah. them SME, but I've kind of forgotten that that literally happened to them overnight. And there's no training for being an SME. You just kind of get, no. Congratulations, you are now an SME. Enjoy. When it comes to working with them, what's your kind of, fundamentally, what's your approach to working with SMEs?
I would say it's an individual. I try to get to know the SME and how they communicate. Because they're so different. Like, I had this amazing SME who was an expert, but I couldn't get them to write anything down. It was just not, they were not that type of person. As soon as they put pen to paper, they blanked.
Wow.
So we changed the entire approach. Usually, you know, I have them, you know, send me stuff that they've written down. But here I basically interviewed them, right, to get to the meat of what needed to be part of that course. And sometimes, you know, okay, someone will hit you with a 200 slide deck and I will, you know, I will adapt my approach, my communication style to that. So I think just being like basic communication theory, I guess, just like, if you want to be able to communicate with them, you have to adapt to how they think and how they communicate and, you know, what gets them excited and you know. And the hardest thing for me is SMEs who don't want to be there.
Yeah.
They're like, this has been given to me on top of everything else. I didn't ask for this. I don't want to do this. It doesn't even feel important to me.
And that's important, right? Because I think actually that's more SMEs than people might necessarily think. I think certainly if you're internal, you'll know that you may have been called on to be an SME and you're like, seriously? More work? Yeah. Great, I was bored otherwise.
Yeah, I had so much free time on my hands.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, and so that's, I mean, also respecting their time. Mm. And sometimes I will call, like, my contact with the client and I will say, I feel like if we're going to reach deadline, you need to relieve my SME of other work for this to be, like, feasible, because I don't see, I can tell they don't have time for me, and that's not going to give you, like, good learning content, and you're going to regret that in the long term, because we're going to create stuff that are hard to recreate or, you know, quickly. Like, if we make a video, if we record someone talking about something, redoing that because we didn't get what we needed because the SME didn't have time to consider what we needed, like, that's going to be a big problem. It's better to relieve them of work now.
Yeah, definitely. It's interesting. I think that kind of goes to that thing of, I think in the past there's almost been this, we know what we're doing, so the SME needs to adjust to us. But I think I totally agree with what you're saying, that actually I think the onus is predominantly, at least, on us to find a way to make it possible for them to help us.
Yeah.
I think otherwise we put a lot of pressure into a relationship that often, especially, I guess, very similar to me, you're not there for years at a time. You haven't got, you know, the first year of your career to just build relationships with SMEs. You're coming in from outside and saying, right, you, let's work together.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it's just a question of, like, I don't know, just being humble and realizing that they have no idea what you're asking them to do, usually. Like, you usually have to start with, like, establishing the framework, right? This is what I do. This is what I need you for. If you feel like you can't do these things for some reason, I need you to tell me that now. Because it's not a given that you will be able to do all these things. But I have no one else who can do them. So if you can't, we need to deal with that right now. So for some projects, I have three SMEs, right? Because there is not one person who can be the SME. Or sometimes I will have a group rather than an SME that will go over everything. And one client I had, they wanted to sort of establish, like, a lot of routines, but there was nowhere else to find what the routines were.
Right.
Right. So this group had to discuss, like, what should the routine be before I could even start creating training. So that's also a thing, like, I try to be clear with both SMEs and customers, like, if it's not written down somewhere else, I'm not putting it in the training.
Well, otherwise there's always, like, the danger that it's just not actually a thing, it's just opinion from an individual or a group, yeah, or whatever it might be. No, absolutely. I think that's, again, it's, yeah, one of those things that can easily be overlooked, the fact that whatever you create is not momentary, usually. It's ongoing.
Mm. No.
And at the same time, you've got to think of the end user, I think. If they want to recap something, do they really have to redo your whole course? If it was just written
exactly,
down.
Exactly, no. Manual. I mean, do they usually have an intranet or something, right? They should, all the rules, all the routines, all the stuff, they should be there in, you know, easy to access PDFs or whatever, step-by-step instructions. Mm. And if they're not, I try to work with them parallel to create those at the same time, at least, so that when we launch the course, they are also available.
This is it. I think it's the, I always describe it as the less sexy side of that world is knowledge management rather than L&D. I feel like instructional design and e-learning and video is all very exciting, and knowledge management is a bit like the company's librarians. But actually, it's essential.
Yeah.
Because otherwise stuff drifts around, and then this SME knows everything about everything, but it's not documented.
Yeah.
It's like, are you not terrified? What if they get hit by a bus?
Mm.
I know it's a morbid thought, but, you know.
Yeah, no, but it's also like, your training can't be the rule book.
No, this is it.
Like, you can't say, if you want to know how to do your job, you have to go back to the training or you have to take this training. Like, and it can't be like, what happens if the training, I don't know, gets old and isn't updated, or and you change rules, etc. Like, it has to be like, usually if we reference documents, I usually even add this little, you know, warning sign, like the latest digital copy on the internet is the one that is that you have to follow. So if this is not the same, it's the internet copy that is the correct one always, because I know things are going to change, and I just want to make sure that we establish, you know, where do you find the answers if you're insecure, or if you have several answers.
No, definitely.
Which one do you go with?
Yeah, it was one of my favourite things to do, actually, when building, especially like induction and onboarding content, is most of the content was actually saying, to learn how to do this, go to the knowledge base page, whatever it might be, because then the knowledge team will keep that up to date automatically. Then you don't have to update the training, because you're just pointing them to what they're actually going to use in their job, rather than telling them in a learning environment that is not real. You know, there's always that kind of, oh great, this is onboarding training. So if I forget, and back then it was working at a water company even, so it was kind of like, you know, whether it's pipe work or how something connects or what to do when someone moves home and these kinds of things. Processes like that change all the time. I speak to L&D teams now and they're like, oh, we have to update this course every 3 to 6 months. It's just like, why? You're clearly writing your courses wrong.
Yeah, or you don't need a course.
Well, yeah.
Because that's also, I mean, and it's kind of counterintuitive as a consultant to tell people you don't need training. Mm. Like, they come to me and they're like, we need training. And I, you know, we go through it and I'm like, no, you don't need training. You need a manual.
Yeah.
I'm like, you don't need training. You need to upgrade your internet. Or, you know, because if this information is not available anywhere, of course, people are not working in this way. That's a given. Try to create the manual first. And if that's still not working, maybe we should consider training. Or just making a better manual, or making sure that people know where to find the manual, etc. But yeah, no, it's. But I find that for me, I kind of include that in learning, right? If you want to, like, when I say I work with learning, I don't just make courses. I make any and every type of content you might need to create, you know, growth, learning. People doing their job correctly, effectively, etc. And it doesn't really matter what format that has or what label we put on it. To me, it's learning.
Yeah, and it's funny. I find more and more that I'm speaking to clients as performance. We're using that kind of language rather than learning. Because I think... I get why we are learning and development, and we talk a lot about learning and the science of learning, and it's all important, but it's not actually what the business wants. The business doesn't want learned employees. They want competent and performant employees. I do sometimes wonder if we're kind of, as an industry, focusing a lot on the process and not actually on what we're trying to achieve. It's quite interesting, because when you read, whether it's stuff by Guy Wallace or anyone else who really focuses on performance, you do kind of read it and go, huh, that's all the best practices of L&D captured in that industry. If we focus a little more, it'd be more effective, certainly. It's interesting you say about as a consultant, it's tricky or counterintuitive to say, yeah, you don't need training. But I think when we don't do that, and it might disagree, but when we don't do that and we just plow ahead, we kind of devalue everything that we do in the industry, but also we kind of set that stage of everything is a training issue moving forward. So it kind of becomes a rod for our own back.
No, absolutely. And it's also like, if the courses are not, you know, giving the value that the client is expecting, they're not going to come back to me, absolutely. Right? So it's also about being like a good partner to your clients, and saying, and sometimes I say, like, if you really want to build learning, like, I will, I'll build you some training. I just don't believe that that's the solution. Yeah. If you're adamant that this is what you want, you know, you have money, I need money, I have a business, you want to buy something from my business, like, you can have whatever you want, but I just can't recommend this.
And I think that's it. And I think that's why I get a little bit concerned sometimes when we hear quite combative language within our industry about how we need to tell them they're wrong and that, you know, it's us against the business and all this kind of thing. And I kind of think, I always use a phrase, I run a business, not a religion. Like, it's not the learning gospel of Tom in my business. It's, you know...
That would be interesting, right? Though.
but we're very much on the view, sort of similar, that if a client wants something that we're like, oh, that doesn't sound like a good solution, well, let's, rather than saying, no, you're wrong, we're the experts, you don't know what you're talking about, you know, give us a seat at the table, ugh, what a phrase, all that stuff, it's much more an approach of, well, look, here are our concerns. This is why we don't think this is the right way to go. But ultimately, it's your business. L&D is I would argue L&D as an industry is a servant industry. We are there to support the completion of other stuff. And maybe just that acknowledgement of, we make no business money. L&D just costs money in terms of real world finances. We are an expense. And we can talk about, you know, generating money for the business indirectly and that kind of thing. But as far as a business is concerned, sales generate money and L&D is an expense. The danger is that if we create ineffective stuff, we become a luxury expense as opposed to a necessary expense, right? That's quite interesting.
And also, I mean, I think it's also about offering them an option, right? Something else, instead of just saying, this is a bad idea, or you're doing everything wrong. You can be like, I have concerns about this. I have a counter proposal. Yes. Like, this is what I suggest. This is what I think would help. Or like, why don't we start here? So sometimes I'll try to work like in stages, like, let's not start with building learning, right? Let's start with doing manuals. And once we have manuals, we can evaluate how well they work, if people find them or not. And then we can discuss, do we need training or do we maybe need an information campaign? Because that could also be, because there's also this kind of gray area between information and training or learning, right? Where they want to stuff information into the format of training to get the ticked boxes and the et cetera. And so also trying to be clear about, no, but this is not a training issue, it's a communication issue. And, you know, maybe we could use the LMS for this or your platform, et cetera. Like, I'm not saying that's not an option, just let's not call it training. Let's say we have information modules that you have to take to be up to date, right? That's fine, just don't call it training.
And I feel like sometimes we kind of go, oh, that's a distinction without a difference. But I really don't think it is, because I think it's fair to say, certainly from my perspective, as an end user, I have very different expectations of what I will get out of training versus reading some information or a comms piece, as I'd often refer to it as. And I feel like in most of the jobs that I've had that haven't been L&D, the amount of training that I've needed has been minimal. What I needed was information clearly communicated to me. You know, whether that's a PDF or a video or a whatever it might be. Yeah.
An email or a website or anything. No, and that's the thing, right? So I think I try to be a business consultant in a sense, not just an L&D consultant. So I will come in, you know, I will help my clients buy an LMS if that's what they want, create training if that's what they want, evaluate training, create training strategy, yada, yada. But when we want to talk about results and when we want to talk about like real world application, like, so for one training we made posters to go with it, like that would go up on the physical workplaces, like in the, you know, kitchen or whatever that they share. Because just to remind them, like it's a, you know, it's a 7-step process, whatever, right? So we made it like an infographic. The infographic turned into a poster. The poster went up everywhere. And yeah, what's that? That's information. That's not training, right? But it's together, they're strengthening the possible outcome success of this endeavor, whatever we want to call it, training, information, business, blah, blah, blah.
No, it's funny that I'll always remember having a chat with someone in a comms team about posters. Because I was a bit kind of like, huh, do posters work and where can you put them? Because people tend to just walk past them and not look. And I started to say, what do you think? What's your opinions? What have you found? And he's like, there's one place in every office you can put posters and people will look at them and see them regularly. And he's like, you put them on toilet doors.
The bathroom.
And I was like, yeah, that's genius. And all of a sudden I was...
And so underused.
It's funny. All of a sudden I was walking around like, went to the toilet, closed the door. I was like, huh, yeah, posters all the time. Didn't even realise I was looking at them. I wonder how much that's sunk in over the years. And now, yeah. whenever we do a campaign piece, we talk about toilet doors. And everyone kind of goes, really? And you're like, yeah, no, seriously, you are missing out on a massive communications opportunity if you're not putting comms on toilet doors.
Yeah.
And people are amazed by it, but it's certainly not training. Mm.
No, it's not, but it can help increase the results of training. And that's the thing. So we need to talk about, because that's also, I mean, one of the things that drive me crazy is, you know, manager involvement in behavioral change, etc. Right. So people want training for behavioral change. And you're like, we can be a part of that, but we can't be the biggest part of that. And we need your management involved. And it's a culture thing and yada, yada. And, you know, yes, we can help assist in that. But there is no training that will make you change your behavior, especially not if it's half a day, which is what you're asking.
Or my personal you know? Favorite, the 15-minute e-learning module that will fundamentally change your beliefs about the workplace, right?
Yes. That's hypnosis, though, right? That's what it is. You click next twice, and then it's just...
Well, it's going to have to be. Yeah.
You're brainwashed.
It's a funny old...
Yeah, if it's going to give any results. Yeah. No, but so... And I think also like being a good business partner, but just even if you're an internal L&D, just managing expectations, right? Just being clear about this is the results you can get from training. Like training is amazing. Training can do so many things, but it can't do this. It can't do that. It has limitations.
I think even if you are internal, having a decent understanding of the business that you're in, I think is still really vital.
Yeah.
Because I think, well, especially at the minute, I was having a chat with someone the other day that I'm mentoring, and we were sort of chatting about what should they be doing right now. Their business is undergoing a little bit of contraction because of the economy that we're now heading into. They're in a space where... there are going to be redundancies, but not within learning and development. They're already a very small team. So they're in the position where the business acknowledges their importance. He said, but how do I now kind of promote doing new things and all this other stuff whilst acknowledging the fact that the business is contracting, not growing? And I was quite impressed, actually, that someone on an internal team was thinking in that way, because I think quite often... we do fall into that kind of L&D ego side of, we are the most important department in the business. And, you know, how could you even think of reducing L&D or not spending money on X, Y, and Z? And part of me gets it. And part of me knows that when my first year, I was probably exactly like that. Because we work in the industry because we see how important it is, right? And we love it and we're passionate about it. But the reality is, if a company is contracting, it's probably not the time to go, let's talk about a new LMS.
No, probably not. And just also, I think the tone in which you create content needs to be adapted to what's going on in the company. So if we're going through reductions and, you know, people are getting redundant and Like, you can't have a video with your, you know, CEO going like, hey guys, everything's so great, welcome to this course. Like, you're not releasing that during that time. You know, you could do a more like somber version of that, like, hi guys, you know, there's a lot going on right now. Things are changing in the industry and the world, and therefore we have this training to help you adapt and, you know, help us grow, etc. That's fine, but you just need to match the tone to what's going on if you're doing new stuff.
Absolutely. And that's such a simple thing to do as well. Mm. But I feel like sometimes it's easy to become blind to it, right? Yeah. Business acumen is not really, again, like SME management, it's not on the list of core L&D skills even now.
No, it's not.
Which is kind of concerning in some ways. Mm. Quite often when we consult with internal L&D teams, we'll talk to them about budget and how they're spending that across a 5-year period. Mm. And it's not in the skill set of anyone on the team, even those responsible for the budget. Like, they could be fantastic L&D professionals, but they've just got no concept of what role, or comparatively speaking, where their budget sits in the business. And what it looks like, and what other people's perception of their use of a budget is going to be like.
Yeah,
it's quite fascinating.
And also, it's hard for people to understand if they have a big or small budget, I think, because they don't know what other companies have as a budget. So as a consultant, I think that's easier, because we talk to lots of people and we know what kind of a healthy budget is for a project versus what it's not, right? Whereas internally, you're just given this bag of money and it just has to be enough.
Yeah.
No matter what happens. And sometimes it is a big bag of money and sometimes it's not,
Though I must admit, I think I found, if I'm honest, the best or certainly the most innovative, I think, solutions that I've seen internally from businesses have come from smaller budgets.
Yeah, but restrictions feed creativity, right? So that's...
Definitely.
I mean, assuming that the people on board are creative and engaged and want to create good learning, I think sometimes restrictions or a lower budget can be helpful, because you can't go with your like usual thing.
Yeah.
But I've also seen examples where that just means everything's created in storyline and looks the same and feels the same and sounds the same, and there's no new anything, because we're paying for storyline, so that's what we're using, and we're paying for this LMS, so that's what we're using. And so I think it can go both ways. Depends on the team, I think, and the sort of management and company culture around it.
I think one thing I have seen with the larger budget side of things sometimes is just an over-reliance on money will fix it.
Yeah, no, but that's the thing. I don't think they know what they need the money for, because they don't know how much anything is. So usually I will create if they ask me to create something, I will also give them a quote, right? I usually actually charge hourly, because I prefer that, because most of my clients don't really know what they want. So I know they're going to change their mind. And that's just easier to deal with than a fixed price. But they will be given a ballpark, this is what I think it's going to be if we follow this plan that I'm suggesting. To give you what you want. And sometimes people will be like, oh, not more. And others will be like, how much are you? And I'm not changing my variables, right? It's just their previous experience of budgeting for L&D and what they, I guess, think training is.
Yeah.
They're like, how much can it take to make some PowerPoints? And you're like, no, that's not what I do.
Yeah, I must admit, it took me a long time to get over the urge for that response to be, well, you do it then.
But I mean, no, I actually, what I do now is I do a version of that, which is really nice, which is, well, long term, I could teach you to do it yourself, and that would save you a lot of money.
That's a good shout. That's a very good
shout. So just like, because also I feel like while I don't want to lose my clients, I also don't want to do the same thing over and over again.
Yes.
So I do want to help my clients long term become more self-sufficient, especially for things like making really simple animated videos or voiceovers or, you know, updating content or creating their own, you know, fairly okay looking PDFs. Like I feel like I'd rather teach them how to do that and then go do something else somewhere else than have them be reliant on me. Yeah, no, absolutely.
Because I think there is certainly at some level within L&D, certainly I think maybe in mid to junior L&D positions, there is sometimes resentment to things being outsourced that they could do or learn to do.
Absolutely, yeah.
Especially with the amount of money that us swindling consultants charge for our services. But I think part of that does come from a history of don't tell other people how to do it because then you won't have a job, you know? But we're not really in that market anymore. As you say, I think there's always another... there's always someone looking for help on something, as you say. So I think we do ourselves, I think, credit, and we improve the position of the industry by helping organisations improve rather than just going, yes, I'll take your money.
Here's your e-learning.
Yeah.
Thank you for your business.
this is it. I mean...
Yeah, no, we're not selling pizza, right? So...
Yeah.
But it's also... Like, even if the company or the client becomes more self-sufficient, that might mean that they will need me for other more fun, advanced things that they can't be taught or that they don't need often enough for it to be worth teaching someone how to do, etc., right? So it doesn't mean that I necessarily lose the client. It just means that I can help the client with different things.
This is it. And I think if a relationship with a client doesn't evolve over time, it's not really good for either of you.
No, you're
stagnating and they're not really getting value for money because they're effectively paying to fix kind of individual tactical problems. But on a strategic level, they're not making any progress. And it's funny, I look back and I've got clients that originally I came in and made all their content for them. Now, whenever they hire someone new to the L&D team, we train them for like 5 days in the approach that we created for them and how to use their content. That's now all we do for them. Arguably, it's far less work, but, you know, it's allowed us to evolve and it's allowed the business to become more self-sufficient. And I wonder, had I just said, no, we don't do that, but I'm happy to keep making content with you, would I have any work with them now?
Probably not. They'd find someone else to do that then, I think.
Exactly.
But, I also just think a client, you know, a client wants to be, they want to feel like their consultants or, you know, companies they hire actually care about them.
Definitely.
Right, and their business, right? So by me saying, you know, yes, I'll come in, I'll build this for you, but if you add this much, I'll also train you to do it yourself in the future. Or like, that means they understand that I care and that will give us a great relationship going forward, which also leads to recommendations, right? Which is also super important when you're a consultant or have your own company, that someone else says, well, we hired Linnea. And boy, let me tell you, it was amazing. Rather than, you know, yeah, we've been stuck with her for 5 years now. She does the same thing over and over again. It's okay, I guess.
But you do hear that, especially about some of the kind of big firms. So in the UK, I've heard the, oh, yeah, we're pretty tied in with blah-de-blah, because we bought into their platform and they made our content for us, but we don't really have any internal talent. So now whenever we need anything, we just go to them. But it takes ages and it's expensive and it's all very their style. It's not really about us. And I think that's often, I think that's how smaller consultancies and freelancers are now being able to get these kind of roles. Because you do kind of go, well, how can an individual or a 3 or 5 person business compete with these big companies? It's like, well, that's exactly how, by behaving like a small organization rather than an industry Goliath kind of thing.
Yeah, because it's also like, I don't sell run-of-the-mill content that I create very similarly for all my clients. Yeah. I don't use templates that I've created that we use over and over again. It's all bespoke, right? It's all, you know, it's all their fonts, all their colors, all their style, right? So I will then source, you know, the type of video, the type of animation and the type of, you know, imagery, etc., that is consistent with their brand. And that makes people confused sometimes when you go into a new relationship with a client. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, okay, so I need your graphic identity guidelines, right? I need all your color palettes and all your logos, high resolution. And they're like, what are you going to do with them? You know, and I'm like, well,
I'm going to sell them on the black market.
Yes. I was like, no, I'm gonna make sure that all your content looks like your branding.
Yeah.
Even though I made it, and so if I make something for someone else, that it's not going to look the same. And they're like, oh, that's really nice. And you're like, yeah, kind of nice.
It's kind of the job.
It's kind of what I do. No, but I think sometimes because I'm not necessarily like. I know some companies, you know, there's the marketing department and the L&D department, and there's not necessarily a bridge between those, which there should be, by the way, that they should basically be attached by the hip. Because there is so much overlap in what they do and the tech they need and platforms, etc., that I don't see why they are not closer connected in general. But usually the communication department then cares about the brand guidelines, right? And the L&D department hardly knows they exist.
This is the sad reality, and I always kind of promote that kind of, whenever you're starting an L&D kind of project, you want someone from, whether it's brand or visual identity or whoever, whatever your business calls it, you want them on the project, only to consult, yes, but...
Yeah.
And I think L&D gets nervous when we talk about, oh, give brand a sign-off. We're not talking about the content and the delivery format, but just let them look at your content and say, hey, actually, that's not how we use the brand, you know?
Mm. Yeah. The logo is not supposed to be on this colour background.
This is simple stuff,
But it's not a big deal, and it's actually a big help, especially if you're not a graphic designer yourself.
Yes.
To have those eyes that are trained in that way, you should see that as an asset, not an inconvenience.
And a potential time saver.
To get their help.
And
I mean, they might have a great template that you can use, right? So like an amazing PowerPoint template, or they might even use the same video software you do, and they already have like great logo animations, etc., that they reuse, that you could use. Just get really cozy with your comms or branding or whatever department.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, we're crazy enough. We're coming up on the end of our hour, which has flown past. I always like to finish with the same couple of questions. So as you look out on the L&D landscape as it sits before us today, what do you see and get really excited about and think, yes, I want to see more of that? And what do you see that you're less excited about or wish you weren't seeing?
Okay, so I guess I was at this workshop right before summer to see like soft skill training in VR.
Ooh.
That got me kind of excited. There was training for like, unhappy staff members. Like if you want to, you know, how to, as a manager, deal with your unhappy staff. And they had taken in actors who, you know, actually yelled and, you know, they were bad actors, right? They were real actors, not like we had someone from come in and pretend to be
Steve
like,
from
they
accounts.
Were real actors.
Yeah,
came in and pretended to be angry for a bit. No, but they were real actors. And it was a very different experience. And it also took away all the, like, you can't play with your phone at the same time. You can't check your email at the same time, right? It's completely consuming with all your senses, which also means that I believe that's going to be great for attention, right? Because you're not going to be distracted in the same way. And you have to make decisions, right? And you get consequences. And it's more like a real life simulation. Well, it's closest you get, right, while using tech. So that was fun. And now I want to do that. And I need to get a really good 360 camera and a bunch of actors. But that's exciting. I think what I see that I hate is the people who are just continuing to buy the same things, publishing the same things, like the SCORM swamp, if you will, right, where it's just, and they continue buying these platforms or these LMSs that are so restricting, and they have no idea because they don't have the tech skills in-house to understand what they're buying. Mm. And then they're like, oh, no, we can't do that. We can't do this. We can't do, you know. So that's saddening me a lot. I mean, there's lots of good things coming up, but unless people are picking up on that and sort of going with it, it doesn't really help that just a few people are, you know, looking to the future.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the stagnancy is what worries me the most, and, like, the complacency.
I definitely agree with that, and I think... when you go to a conference these days, it's quite concerning how samey a lot of the big solutions have become. Like, even the ones that started off being very breakaway, on the edge, different, have kind of just gradually moved back to the safe ground of the centre. I just admit, I do struggle at the moment to look, especially platform-wise, I struggle to look out there and say, wow. Like, there are some cool potentials, but everything is either, like, not quite there yet, but has good ambition, or has no ambition and is never planning to change.
Yeah, and I mean, but what I see when they are developing platforms, etc. as well, is nobody's really considering pedagogy, right? They're, it's just, like, tech. Mm. So there's too much tech thinking and too little pedagogy thinking. And everyone's just trying to make sure that they have all the features everyone else have so that they can't be, knocked out of the competition because they don't have this or that feature, rather than be like, we actually thought about how learning works and we created this framework that is helpful in learning. What I do like, I see some platforms that are a combo, like a communication and training platform.
Yes. Yeah.
And that I like. That, I mean, they're not super innovative or anything, but I like that they are sort of acknowledging that sometimes it's not training, it's information. And since it's hard to differentiate sometimes, we can keep them in the same space or we can use the same app so that the employees don't need to have two apps, etc. Like that makes me a little happy.
Yeah, I think it's kind of similar in that I quite like kind of Docebo, LearnAmp, Thrive to a point where they're all kind of focusing on not just upload your SCORM file here. They're trying to think about, as you say, what is the comms channel? How does kind of coaching and mentoring and skill goals and gradual progression fit into this platform? Like, none of them have nailed it. But they're all at least trying to go in that direction, which really helps.
Yeah, yeah. They have, you know. Yeah, I think I was at an event where they presented Thrive to, like, Swedish companies because it was sort of new in Sweden. And I looked at it and, you know, a lot of it is like, they're like, this is really innovative. And I'm like, but some of the things I do really like. One of the things I like... that I can't believe not everything has is if you reuse a module, the system knows you've already done it and doesn't force you to take it again.
Yeah.
Why is that not everywhere?
This is it. And it's one of those funny...
Because that drives me nuts.
This is it. It's one of those funny things where, 6 or 7 years ago, Docebo did it. And it was actually one of the main reasons we brought that in. At the company I was in at the time, because no one else offered it. It's because, you wouldn't put the same bit of learning in multiple learning pathways. It's like, yeah, you would.
Definitely.
The moment that came out of the announcement, it was like, you fundamentally do not understand what learning is here, do you? Like, this is... they had a very, again, just a very traditional, a course is a piece of e-learning, or... an in-person experience, or a this. It could never be a combination thereof, or ever have options. Like, it blew their mind. I was like, well, I'd like to give people the option. Go to a session, complete the e-learning, or listen to a podcast, but you only have to do one of them. And they're like, well, it's just not made for that kind of thing. Like, really? And that's pretty basic. Mm.
Yeah, exactly. No, and that's, yeah, it's sad that that is still hard technically with the platforms, etc., to achieve. Because it's such a simple thing, really, right, to say, we would like to give you options. Because we don't really care. Because I try to say, like, I don't really care how you learn the thing. I just want you to learn the thing. I just want you to, you know, do whatever correctly. And I don't really, I mean, if you didn't even take the training and you still learned how to do that, like, I'm not even going to be upset, because that was the end goal. The training in itself means nothing. The end goal means something. So as long as you reach the end goal, I don't really care how you got there.
No, I think that's...
And I don't mind giving you some options.
I think that's a brilliant sort of point there. So we are up against time. So there's loads of things that you're doing. You've got your YouTube channel that we'll link in the description. Mm. You've got GLDC. Tell us a little bit about GLDC.
Yeah, so I became the co-organizer of the GLDC in February this year. But the GLDC is the Global Learning and Development Community. It started out being like a hangout space for people in L&D, basically doing Friday meetups, just going to different breakout rooms, getting to know people, helping people, very like organic and spontaneous. And it's grown from there. So now we have meetups on Wednesdays as well, so we cater to all time zones. And we have a platform. We have this group on Thursdays who just talk about like articulate storyline, e-learning heroes challenges, stuff like that. We have, during the summer, we've had an initiative where we've helped teachers transitioning into L&D. So we've been focusing on them on Fridays. And we're going to continue helping them. We haven't decided exactly on the format yet. And we also have a mentorship program. As I mentioned, I am one of the GLDC mentors. And so we actually, without any cost, offer mentors. So it's people in the GLDC helping other people in the GLDC. And I think that's like what I love the most about the GLDC, is it's a space to connect, but also to give and get help. And you can do both at the same time. You can both need a mentor and be a mentor, right? Definitely. You can both attend groups and be in charge of groups, etc. So if you're interested in any of that, you go to mygldc.com and you find all the information needed.
Fantastic.
There.
And obviously we'll have a link to that in the description of this episode as well. And finally, if people want to get in touch with you and continue the conversation, where's the best place to do that?
LinkedIn is good. I hang out way too much on LinkedIn. But otherwise, I do have a website, linneakjergren.se, and you can go there and find every type of contact information you might desire.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of the Ideas Podcast. Before you go, please consider leaving a review, a comment and a like on YouTube, and of course, letting us know in the comments what you're taking away from this conversation. Until next time, have a great day.